This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stachow. France and Croatia will battle for the top spot at the 21st FIFA World Cup this Sunday. The tournament attracts millions of viewers from around the globe, and according to FIFA, the last World Cup final in 2014 drew a record 1 billion viewers. That was nearly 15% of the global population. So what is it about the game that resonates with fans from so many nationalities? And how has a sport that emerged in 19th century England become the cultural lifeblood of so many disparate countries? In his new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer, Duke University professor Laurent Dubois breaks down the sport's big historical moments. He also looks at the superstar players who've won over fans worldwide. Laurent Dubois is a professor of history and romance studies and the director of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke University. He also teaches a class on soccer politics and runs the Soccer Politics blog. Laurent, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we would have loved to have you in studio, but lucky for you, you are actually in Europe. You're actually in France for this World Cup. What is the vibe like where you are right now?
Well, it's been incredible, and I actually, you know, in the back of my mind, I hoped that I would be in Paris with France in the World Cup final, and here we are. I was rooting also for the Belgian team, which had an incredible run, so it's been really exciting, and Tuesday night when France qualified for the final, you know, the whole city exploded in celebration, spent hours out on the streets, and it was quite wonderful.
I am jealous, and I want you to tell us a bit about how we got to this moment. How did soccer as we know it now begin?
Well, the rules of the game are kind of set down as we know them today in 19th century England. It's really a sport that emerges out of the schools and universities of England in the 19th century. And the codification of soccer, actually the term itself comes from, it was called association football because it was the rules were set down by the Football Association, which was created in the mid 1860s. And those rules really were about making it so that different schools could kind of play games against one another. They had slightly different rules and they kind of codified them in one set of rules. It's actually a sport that's linked in its historical roots to rugby, to American football, even though, of course, they seem very different today. But this particular form that took shape there, which is the form where you can't move the ball around with your hands unless you're the goalie, and a number of other rules that we're familiar with, that ended up spreading in the 19th century with a kind of rapidity that almost no other cultural form we know of, you know, sort of has had. It moved from continent to continent, and by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, you could really find it all over the world. And I guess that's part of the mystery that's been interesting to me as a historian and trying to understand the game is what is it about that particular set of rules that made it so that it could be adopted in so many places and become so indigenous, in a sense, all over the world as it is today.
Well, what is it about that? Because it seems to me that soccer really takes on its own entity in each country that it lands in. I know my family is British, and I went to a soccer match with my family last time I was in England, and it felt like a completely different sport from what I had experienced as a fan in the United States. So what is it about soccer that allows it to be so malleable?
It's a great question. I think on the one hand, it is a fairly simple, open form, so it's kind of a language that's recognizable, and it's important that, you know, you sort of feel like it's the same sport. You can kind of grasp it in different contexts, and yet what you can do in these different contexts, just in the way that an individual player plays, how they move their body, how they move the ball around, the way that the collective works, how they position themselves on the field, are they going to be more defensive or attacking, or how are they going to use the space of the field, it's very open, right? Unlike American football, which is a kind of measured space, the soccer field is a kind of wide open space, and there's so many different configurations that kind of can unfold. So it does provide a space where people can kind of express themselves, I think, in ways, and then people who are watching or playing can create all kinds of narratives about what that means, you know, make a connection between maybe a certain kind of play and what that means almost philosophically, right? Do you play in a certain kind of way that's more offensive and open and joyous because that's the expression of your culture, or do you try to have a kind of very tactical, organized approach? And people, obviously, sometimes these are almost inventions or mythologies, but there is a way in which it does sustain a kind of idea that play and culture are interlinked. And I do think that's part of what makes it so interesting and popular for people.
And it also lets us play out sort of ideas of nationalism, who we think our country is, who the vision of our country we want to project onto the world. And that has an interesting link to the origin story of the World Cup itself. Tell me about sort of this myth that maybe it was created to strike peace.
So the person who kind of invents the World Cup or who leads its creation is a man named Jules Rimet, who is a Frenchman who had survived World War One. He had been an officer during World War One, and like many of his generation after World War One and all over the world, there was this kind of sense that, you know, the disaster of that war, the bloodiness of that war, meant that new ways had to be invented for nations to kind of relate to each other. You obviously had the League of Nations and other projects. So the World Cup was really infused with this idea that, you know, you were going to have nations and that nations needed to express themselves and maybe be proud of themselves and perhaps even compete with each other. But they needed to do so in a way where there was a kind of understanding of set of rules and maybe a kind of a means of solidarity, right? That if you play a game against another country, that's actually a way of connecting to them, even while you're still kind of competing. So that was part of the vision of the early World Cup. And it was something that many people hoped. What they found, you know, that there was already this kind of language, that they experienced this in the 20s when Uruguayan teams came to the Olympics and just shocked everyone. They played this incredible soccer from this country that, you know, was across the seas from Europe and people weren't familiar with it, and people loved the way they played. And so there was this kind of experience of discovering other peoples through the game that was a common language, but then it could also be infused with new meaning. And sort of since then, obviously, the World Cup has been used in all kinds of different ways politically. It was actually mobilized by Mussolini just a few years later in the late 30s to kind of shore up and help, you know, kind of give legitimacy to his regime in Italy. So it's obviously been deployed in all kinds of ways since. But I do think at the heart of it, there is this kind of initial, original utopian dream that maybe still resides within it and that still draws people to it because it is just the ultimate global competition.
Well, and there's sometimes even a contrast between what the team is projecting on the field and what political leaders may be saying about the team. I think Marine Le Pen is an interesting example of this contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, in France, the fact of the matter, of course, is that on the one hand, the soccer teams, the national soccer teams, can, if they win a World Cup, I mean, they can basically be the most beloved people in a country ever. You know, they're going to be more beloved. If this team wins the World Cup, you know, the French people will love them more than they love any politician ever. You know, and at the same time, most players, of course, people who do athletics in a lot of countries are often coming from more socially disadvantaged or marginal communities. You know, athletics is a tough career. People use it, I think, when they don't necessarily have other options as much. And so you have a French team now where most of the people on that team have grown up in pretty poor circumstances. The majority of them are children of immigrants, mostly from Africa. That was already true in earlier iterations of the team. So the vision of the country that you get when you look at the team is very different than certainly what the political class looks like. And that's true all over the world. So you do have an opportunity where what the country looks like when you look at the team is quite powerful. I mean, in a way, what it looks like is really what the country is like, right? France is actually a very diverse country, and this is really a true representation of the country, in a sense more true than the political class, which is far less diverse, actually. But that's how soccer kind of I think that these national competitions do offer an opportunity to imagine the country a little differently and to kind of look in a different kind of mirror.
And to see sort of the history of how the country has evolved through the stories of the players, which I feel like you do so well in your book. You tell these really interesting narratives about immigrants. One woman, Nadia Nadim, an Afghan refugee who ends up in Denmark, but she is able to play soccer because the refugee center happens to be next to a soccer field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite stories. Escapes Afghanistan after her father is killed by the Taliban. They arrive in Denmark in the middle of the night, almost kind of randomly, and then she happens to grow up in Denmark, where there's a pretty nicely funded, you know, soccer infrastructure right next to this big youth sort of academy, but sort of where there's youth teams. And she eventually gets the courage up to ask if she can play too. Her first soccer ball she finds in the trees above the fence outside the soccer fields, because there's so many balls kicked over there. And, you know, she then goes on to become, she's now a star of the Danish women's team. She's played in the Portland Thorns and elsewhere. And, I mean, it's kind of a great story. And there are lots and lots of stories like that of people who, again, find the sport a way in and then ultimately become a different kind of symbol for countries.
There's also this way in which our ideas about gender and gender dynamics are played out on the field. And that has a pretty interesting history. We may think of soccer as a traditionally masculine sport, a sport in which men have really excelled. But you really look at how there have been a lot of strong women players, and women have been really involved in the sport since the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I insist from the beginning, obviously, soccer, women's soccer is as old as soccer itself. Women have played it as long as the sport has been around. And in the early 20th century, and I tell this story, there was a real expansion of women's soccer in England with some remarkable players. I talk about Lily Parr, who was this really amazing forward during that period.
14, right? She was 14
right.
years old?
Right, she starts at 14. These are factory women who, you know, a lot of the early teams in general were emerging from factories. They become factory teams, which both men and women's. And women started playing really during World War One, mostly, and then emerge and kind of develop a whole network of. I mean, they had played before, but these sort of there's a kind of expansion of teams during World War One, and they end up kind of becoming this very popular team from one factory, and they tour around. They actually play international games against France. Ended up in the U.S. touring, where they played against men's teams at one point. But also, their popularity kind of so threatened the Football Association in England that they ended up banning women's soccer, sort of holding it back. And that's a phenomenon we see all over the world. And it's one of the things I really wanted to explain to people is that it's not that women's soccer hasn't been around the whole time. It's that it's been really held back by institutions. And now we're finally kind of pushing forward with it. But its current situation is the result of policies that were put in place by men to essentially to refuse women the kind of access to the sport that they deserved.
Yeah, you lay out how, you know, there were thousands of people that would come to these women's games, and it sort of upset the institution so much that they then said, you know, actually, soccer is not good for your health and fertility.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah. This to women who were all working in factories, right? They were told that it would be dangerous for them to play a game, right, at soccer. But it's true that it was really on purpose, you know, and I think that's important because today sometimes people sort of sense, oh, well, women's soccer is developing, we're encouraging it, but it's a young game, but it's not a young game at all. It just was, I think, so that what we're doing now is trying to reverse the effects of these earlier policies rather than something else.
Well, I want to talk a bit about some of the really magical moments in the World Cup so far. I know you wrote a piece talking about the hop from Belgian player Romelu
Lukaku. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I called it a hop. It's actually what people tweeted at me. It's like, it's called a dummy, which is true. It's sort of when you trick another player, but I didn't like that word as much as there was a way in which he just kind of, it was right at the waning minutes of the Belgium-Japan game, and it was 2-2, so it was about to go into overtime. An incredible game. Japan played a beautiful game, and Belgium was a really, I mean, they both kind of faced each other in this kind of honest and full way. Right at the end, a kind of a burst from the Belgian team. And essentially what was happening was that Lukaku is the striker, is the number nine that sort of is always at the point of the team and is supposed to put the goal in. He was receiving a pass that was actually quite beautifully placed, but he was covered by the Japanese captain. And I think he just understood that the whole expectation was that he was going to try to take the goal. And so all the Japanese players were kind of moving it like a magnet towards him. But he also knew that just behind him was his teammate Nasser Chadli. So in just a kind of really delicate way, he just kind of moved a little bit, hopped over the ball so that it went streaked right past him, and Nasser Chadli was able to power it into the net. And I just loved that moment just because it sort of embodied so much of the connection between teammates, the whole point that he needed to give up the opportunity to score so that his team could win, and to do so by using the fact that the script was sort of on the plate for him to score, and the Japanese players were sort of following that script, and then he wrote it. Kind of rewrote it at the last minute instead, and you know, had he tried and missed, right, that would have been the mistake. So also, of course, these are Belgian players. Romelu Lukaku is the son of Congolese immigrants. Nasser Chadli of Moroccan immigrants, receiving a pass from a Belgian player who's not of immigrant background. So this kind of connection between different groups, that you can see sometimes symbolically played out on the pitch was one of the things that drew me to that moment.
Do you think there's something about soccer that makes it a sport where ego is less at play than others? Because you sort of so beautifully illustrate in this moment, he had to make the choice to pass by making that goal in order for a more successful game. Do you think that's inherent in the game of soccer?
I think it often comes up. I mean, there are moments when people, especially strikers, do need to be egotistical. But there are so many players, right, who are less visible. On the French team, Kante, who's a midfield player, who is probably in some ways maybe the most important player on that team, and I think if you don't watch carefully, you don't realize exactly all that he's doing. He'll probably not score a goal during this tournament, but everything else around him is kind of made possible by what he does in the midfield, and there are a lot of midfielders like that. Actually, the chapter in my book on the midfield sort of makes that point, although there are obviously some midfielders who also are very big scorers. But there is something to that, and there's just this kind of dynamism, you know, partly because the clock doesn't stop. The manager's on the side of the field but can't really do that much. They can, you know, say one or two things. They can substitute players. But really the collective of the team has to figure out what to do in a given situation. I mean, you could see, you know, in the England-Croatia game that when a team sometimes loses a sense of what they're doing exactly, or you can see this often, right, that a team can kind of become confused by what's happening because the other team has broken up their play. And either they kind of pull it together as a collective or they don't, you know, and that's what sort of determines the outcome of a game. But in a sense, no one can come to their assistance, you know. They have to do it together. It's very different than what's possible in basketball or football, where kind of someone can stop the game and kind of try to reset things. Really the only time that happens in soccer is during halftime, and otherwise the flow and the psychological play between the players is really fundamental. The conversations players have amongst themselves, you know, on the pitch are absolutely vital. You kind of can see sometimes older players kind of telling younger players, look, this is going to be all right, let's calm down, let's figure this out. And so there's really all that that's sort of psychological, and you can't hear them, but you can see it playing out. And I think that's one of the things that's most fascinating about watching a soccer game, actually.
Well, so there is something a little bit different, though, that is happening this year that I know you were nervous about, the introduction of video assistant referees that may allow refs to replay moments when before it had to be a game time decision. Can you tell us about that and how you feel like that has affected this year's World Cup?
Yeah, it's been super interesting. And I mean, soccer is a very conservative sport when it comes to changing the rules. I mean, actually the rules have changed surprisingly little since the 19th century, which is, you know, a lot less true for other sports. But the introduction of video was one of the things that was resisted for a very long time. And for, I think, many in the U.S., this was completely puzzling because it's such a basic part of our sport culture that you would, of course, want to use technology to kind of rationalize refereeing decisions. So what they've done at the World Cup is technology they have had introduced already a little bit in a number of other leagues and had started to use, where basically in a very, very narrow set of circumstances, it's actually only in certain circumstances, there's a bank of televisions and there's a set of referees in a room who essentially can review something and tell the referee on the field what they think, and also invite the referee on the field to themselves go and look at the replay. It has to have to do with some very crucial things, you know, a penalty in front of the goal, a goal opportunity, those sorts of things. It can't just be a foul in the middle of the pitch. So it's not used very often. The concern when these things come up is essentially the kind of biggest worry of the soccer fan is that the fundamental flow and movement of the game will be interrupted by mm-hmm. these technologies that will end up with a game that stops and starts all the time, the way that, you know, as a soccer fan, when I watch basketball or football, I feel like is happening, right? So that's the big worry. The result has actually been, I think, different than certainly what I feared. I mean, it has stopped the game at times, but it's been relatively efficient. What's interesting is going to sound funny that I'm going to say this, but what's reassuring to me is that it hasn't at all ended the controversies, right? So it has simply...
The drama is alive and well.
Exactly. The drama is alive and well. Because every once in a while, there are cases where they did the VAR and we looked at the VAR and we're like, okay, yeah, that was probably the right decision. There's actually been a lot of cases where after the VAR was done, people still totally disagreed with what was done. Now there's a new thing, which is why didn't they do the VAR for that? Right? And so people argue about that. And because arguing about refereeing calls, I believe, is actually one of the fundamental things that makes people love soccer so much, I really do believe that. I know it sounds, but the point that people can continue to argue about whether something was right or wrong, about justice and injustice, is actually one of the major reasons this sport gives people so much to talk about. And I actually think, you know, people talk about refereeing calls almost as much as they do about goals. And since the sport fundamentally, you know, is about giving people things, stories to tell and things to talk about, I actually think that will continue. So I think what's interesting is how much the sport has been able to some extent, absorb this new technology and continue to make it a source of drama and argument.
Well, I only have about 30 seconds left, but I know you were in France in 1998 when they won the last World Cup, and you are going to be in France for this weekend's game. What are you hoping for? Give us a quick look ahead.
Mm-hmm. I actually wasn't here in 1998.
Oh, you weren't?
That's why I'm especially excited to be here in 2018. I was here in 2006 when they lost, however. I don't know if that's a bad omen. But I am really excited for this final game. I mean, the team has been kind of stronger and stronger. And, you know, when I go into these things, I mostly just want a really beautiful game. I don't want a dumb game, which happens sometimes. And I think that the Croatian and French teams are going to offer, you know, really a full tilt, exciting match. I am, of course, hoping that it's going to end with a French victory so that we can all celebrate in Paris on Sunday night.
Wonderful. Well, I hope you're not disappointed. Laurent Dubois is a professor of history and romance studies at Duke University. He's also the director of the Forum for Scholars and Publics at Duke, and he teaches a class on soccer politics. His new book is called The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, the music of Deshaun and Soul. Stay with us.